Pennsylvania Code of the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set for oral argument this morning is case number 30521, Lee Todd Malcolm versus Brett Fluke. Paul Lindy is here present and will be arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Malcolm, and Matthew Templer is present, Assistant Attorney General, will be arguing on behalf of the Brett Fluke. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Lindy, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed with your argument, Mr. Lindy.
If it pleases the court, counsel, Lee Malcolm, my client in this case, was convicted of 9 counts of third-degree rape after a jury trial on March 18, 2021. The conviction arises out of the allegation that he engaged in intercourse with his then-girlfriend on October 28, 2019, while she was incapable of consenting due to intoxication in violation of SDCL 22-22-1 sub 4. The victim in this case was the long-term girlfriend of Mr. Malcolm. She died on October 28, 2019 as a result of an unintentional overdose on a prescribed medication of hydroxyzine and baclofen. The evidence in this case consisted almost entirely for the state of videos that Malcolm had recorded the morning of October 28, 2019. This evidence was the state's case in chief and essentially how this whole rape conviction took place. The remainder of the testimony in this case was largely resulting from an unattended death investigation, and clearly the rape allegations were established by the videos that were presented by the state of South Dakota. Due to Malcolm's girlfriend passing away at their home, and this was a home that he shared with his mother and his then-girlfriend, Watertown police and first responders were called to the home. When they arrived at the home, they did the emergency measures and they removed her from the home, but they also sought a search warrant on October 28, 2019. In that search warrant, it related to an unattended death investigation regarding the October 28, 2019 passing of Malcolm's girlfriend. In that affidavit in support of the search warrant, the request was for basically a search of the home and certain other items including Malcolm's cell phone. The warrant was ultimately issued on October 28, 2019, and it authorized the search of the home and the seizure of an unidentified cell phone. During a search later that evening on October 28, 2019, law enforcement did then seize that cell phone. But again, there was nothing in that warrant that would specifically authorize a top-to-bottom search of that cell phone. Instead, it merely authorized at that point in time a seizure of the phone. Following that seizure, law enforcement the next day on October 29th, 2019, did a full download of that cell phone and obtained the videos that are the subject of the allegations against Mr. Malcolm. The affidavit supporting that search warrant contained no particularity as to what data was sought from that cell phone. It didn't specify photos, text, GPS information, anything to that sort. And the warrant that was issued by the magistrate issuing the warrant had no limit in particularity. It just essentially said to seize a cell phone. And to the extent the state now uses that warrant as some type of basis that they were allowed to search the cell phone, that would certainly violate the particularity requirements of the Fourth Amendment.
We don't really need to get to who wins on the Fourth Amendment, right? Or any of it. This was dismissed at a very preliminary stage, and it seems like the correct focus for us isn't to solve the case at this point, but to figure out whether the correct standard was used under 12b-5 and maybe even what that standard should be.
I would agree, Your Honor. I think what I'm trying to do as to the Fourth Amendment is just give some background, but I totally agree with the court that essentially what the standard that the court has used is whether there has been pled. What first, the circuit court has to review the application and assume all facts as true, and then determine whether, based upon those facts, any possible claim could be made. And it's basically what you know, using like the Steiner standard, it's best basically whether there's a minimum threshold of possibility.
So the state suggests that's out of step with the Iqbal sort of Twombly standard, so the difference being conceivable versus plausible. And I know you addressed it in your reply brief, but what standard should we use, and is it outcome determinative in this case?
I don't think it's outcome determinative in this case as to the specific standard, because I think there was adequate information within the amended application that would provide a court with adequate notice under the liberal pleading standards, even considering Iqbal and the later closing of that standard, for a court to determine what was wrong with his trial counsel's performance. It might not have been the most beautifully pled amended application, but it put the state on notice as to what was wrong. There was the legal claim of the ineffective assistance counsel, and there was also the fact that there was a problem with the search warrants and no motion was ever made to try to suppress that.
And I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to kind of clarify, because I wondered, you know, our certificate of probable cause designated each of those within the broad category of ineffective assistance of counsel. When I look at your petition, though, I'm wondering if you're stating what I'll call a freestanding Fourth Amendment claim, and that your unreasonable or your particularity argument is its own claim, standing by itself, or is it part of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim? We kind of, in our certificate of probable cause, we kind of looped it under the IAC. That may not be right when I look at your petition, but perhaps you can tell me.
I think the issue that would come from making a standalone Fourth Amendment claim would be that there would be some type of potential, and I don't think it would be applicable, but some type of potential raised judicata argument that could be made. But at the same time, as part of that ineffective assistance of counsel, which gets around the raised judicata effect, it was never raised by his trial counsel, which would go to his Sixth Amendment right to have competent counsel.
No, I understand that, but did you plead it? I mean, since we're at this early stage, did you plead the Fourth Amendment claim as a standalone claim or as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
I pled it as a standalone claim, but I also incorporated into the ineffective assistance of counsel claim because it was raised that no motion to suppress was made.
Got it. Thank you.
Yes. As I was previously stating, Malcolm was provided appointed counsel to represent him on these charges. No matter what the state may argue in this case, trial counsel's representation in this case was perfunctory, lacking, and quite frankly misguided. To put this into perspective, his appointed counsel filed one motion late in the day to essentially allow Malcolm to wear street clothes to the trial. He didn't ever file a motion to suppress, even though the Fourth Amendment was out there. And then on top of that, he chose a trial strategy that no competent defense attorney would have ever followed.
We don't generally second-guess trial strategy decisions. What factors here would justify viewing counsel's performance on the advance consent defense as more than just a trial strategy? I can see that's where you're going.
Yes, and I think what the problem with the trial strategy goes to the heart of the competency of the lawyer, because I understand that there can be strange and unique trial strategies in any criminal case. sometimes that's all you have is to make some unique strategy. But what I think this court requires, and I think what is required by all counsel, is that if they're going to use a trial strategy, and it's a unique trial strategy, which in this case was pass-out sex, that's what his lawyer argued, which this court recognized in the Malcolm decision on appeal, meant nothing else that other than he was essentially having sex with an unconscious person.
So let me ask you about that, because you know, we made that very clear in State versus Malcolm that was not a valid defense, and it was not going to prevail. There was no advance consent. That's after counsel made this decision, you could call it strategic, to present this defense at trial. Was it that evident to counsel when we look at, you know, again, we're being Monday morning quarterbacks here. Is it that evident that it was a totally improper, ineffective defense at the time that he presented this?
I believe that it was, and I think what the problem with it, it's multifaceted, because if you're going to use a trial strategy, there's a way to find out if that trial strategy is going to be accepted by the trial court. And part of the problem that is not raised because it's beyond the certificate, but one of the problems that was considered by this Supreme Court was that he didn't file a motion to get on under the rape shield law, and then the state made a motion in limine to preclude any evidence concerning prior acts between the victim and Malcolm. At that point in time, the trial court kind of gave trial counsel, you know, some heads up that she wasn't really agreeing with the strategy. But then he kept going on this strategy and made the argument at the opening about what this was going to be about. But the trial court again questioned, you know, just reading the statute 22-22-1 sub 4, it's pretty plain language, and this court stated that in the Malcolm decision too, and that was after the fact. But the trial court said, you know, I'm reading that statute, and your theory of pass-out sex is rape in the third degree. And not only that, during a break later, after the court brought this up to trial counsel, which I think it was too late to fix it at that point in time, but I don't think there was a great trial strategy. I mean, there really hadn't been any motions filed or any defense provided to Malcolm. So even after that, the trial court had her law clerk go and do research and obtained a case from California basically saying that advance consent is not a defense.
So that's your research argument, is that's the type of research that should have been done before this unique defense was used.
Sure. I mean, I think counsel...
And you think the law was clear enough, irrespective of what we decided in Malcolm, that effective counsel would have discovered that issue and through research and said, I absolutely can't use that defense. I'm going to admit my client's guilty if I do that.
Yes, I believe so. And I think I cited to the court in my initial opening brief that there's a provision in American jurisprudence, which is basically a general secondary legal encyclopedia, that advance consent is not a defense to rape. So, I mean, he should have been on notice. And this was, according to the state's argument, a defense attorney who had, you know, 40 years of criminal defense experience, reading criminal statutes should have, you know, been secondhand for him. So
when I look at the petition, and again, that's kind of what I'm focusing on, because that's kind of where we're at. And I look at your factual allegations, I see a number of particular, to use it in a Fourth Amendment sense, right? But specific claims about, you know, criticisms or critiques that you're offering and pleading. But is there, and if we're looking at it sort of in a plausible sort of sense, does it complete the sequence of events to, you know, for stating a claim of ineffective assistance to counsel, to just point out these problems and then say, and that was prejudicial? Do you have to plead, and did you plead something that says there are these problems, And this is the standard and what the standard would have contemplated, at least in general terms, so that we know that you're pleading a baseline of standard, professional standard. You're pleading that he deviated from it, and somehow we can pull together prejudice from that, because it seems like that's what we would need.
Well, and I think, like I said, it may not be the most artfully.
Well, I'm not critical at all. I'm just curious if that's.
I think what the intent was is that at the time the application was made, it was to point out many, many errors. I mean, that was the intent. And I think there was enough in there that his failure to file the motion to suppress could be read consistently with the Fourth Amendment argument. Otherwise, you would just be repetitively discussing the Fourth Amendment argument in certain pages of the application. And I'm not sure if that answers.
Well, how about the trial strategy? I guess, you know, he didn't interview him. He didn't research this, as you're visiting with the chief about. I mean, he didn't do these things. What would have happened if he would have done them? Is there some sort of allegation that, you know, this was, it's not just that he didn't do them, but that this led to prejudice, and a more professional course would have been to do something else?
You can answer the question.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I think the alternative, the allegation is that there were alternative strategies, and he failed to research and obtain any alternative strategies, and I think that comes early on in the ineffective claim. Again, maybe not the most artfully pled, but I don't know what kind of trial strategy a defense attorney is thinking about if they're just not filing the motion to suppress. How can there be a trial strategy not to file a motion to suppress on basically what the trial court, in its order denying the habeas petition, found to be overwhelmingly prejudicial video evidence? So, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lindy.
Loop it in there.
It's a start, Your Honor, but it doesn't go far enough for the pleading standards, because you have to have the deficient performance and the prejudice prong. And so I think two problems with the way it's pled in the prejudice aspect is, one, he pleads chronic. Chronic only applies when you have situations of an actual or constructive denial of counsel. He's made no allegations that that's happened, either in his petition or in the briefing to the circuit court or to this court. It's all a focus on trial counsel's actual work in the case.
Well, the focus, though, in a pleading, and the rules require notice. Are you saying that those allegations in the complaint didn't put the state on adequate notice of what the claims were?
I still
and if so, how did the state not have notice that there's a Fourth Amendment claim in the IAC as part and parcel of that?
So a two-part answer to that, Your Honor. I agree there's something there, but it's not enough. And I think you can, if you say the Jenner standard applies, I think you can look at what this court decided in Jenner itself to show that the way he pled this isn't enough. Because there, this court affirmed the dismissal of Jenner's petition, saying, Jenner, quote, never alleged that there are any experts who would materially contradict Dr. Randall's opinions. Without giving those specifics of who would have contradicted Dr. Randall, there was no way that she pled prejudice or could even prove prejudice. The same here, without giving specifics, we're missing part of the analysis, even at the pleading stage. And I think it's important to point out, for the prejudice analysis, he has to show a reasonable probability of a different result. You can't just use the label that, had this not happened, it would have been a different result, and therefore I was prejudiced. You have to give more, especially in the Fourth Amendment context, because even if he would have filed, if trial counsel would have filed a motion to suppress, you still have the exclusionary rule and the exceptions to that laying out there, and he has to show that, with that reasonable probability of a different result, that an exception to the exclusionary rule would not apply.
You think he has to plead all of those exceptions and show each one of those exceptions in the pleading to prevail on a motion to dismiss?
Plead them, yes. Prove them, no, because then that's when you get to the evidentiary hearing. But you can't just use labels and have that get you to where you need to go. That was Jenner, or even when you go to Cisney, when this court said you can't just use labels. And Cisney's the perfect example when he just alleged a conspiracy. This court said that wasn't enough and then contrasted that with his other claim of talking of fraud and deceit, where he did give examples of the conflicting statements from the food services manager, which got his petition over the line on the pleading standard. So it all has to come down to, is there something more than the labels? And I think if you just look at his bare petition, it's all labels, even with using the incorporation paragraph that Justice Devaney laid out, because while it does give a laundry list of these things that Mr. Malcolm and Mr. Lindy have alleged trial counsel didn't do, it doesn't go the next step, where because of deficient performance, as Justice Kern was pointing out, this court doesn't normally second guess it when it's a strategy decision. And there's a whole host of strategy decisions that can be made. And I think the danger of trying to get to the merits here without having a record is then we do have to guess at that. And trial counsel hasn't been given a chance to explain his thought process and what he was doing. Essentially, right now, we're in the same position that we were on direct appeal when the court refused to consider the ineffective assistance claims because there was no record.
So all of the, following up a little bit with my discussion that I had with Mr. Lindy, so you're saying that just these critiques, okay, you didn't do this, you didn't do this, you didn't prepare him, you didn't do this, those need to be measured against some sort of allegation of objective reasonableness or professional reasonableness?
Yes, Your Honor. I think when looking at this and we're talking about...
Not measured. I mean alleged to be comparatively, you know, assessed or laid against or something like that.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with that. And I think the line for a facially valid petition at this point lies somewhere between what Mr. Lindy and Mr. Malcolm filed as the amended petition and what they've presented in the briefing to this court. It doesn't necessarily need the detail that was in the briefing, but there has to be more than what he gave in that petition, because without more, it can't meet that threshold standard. And I think this comes directly looping in the Twombly analysis that Justice Salter was mentioning before. There's a difference between possibility, plausibility, and probability.
Is there a principled reason why we would not apply that standard in habeas cases as we have in other civil contexts? I did some quick research, but it looks like there's some federal district courts that are kind of using it. I wasn't able to find much in the other states. Is there a good reason to use it, to not use it, arguments that you can think of that would recommend it or make habeas cases different?
This court should use the Cisney standard, not the Jenner, and for multiple reasons. First, it creates the consistency across the board for civil cases, which habeas is. If there's not that consistency, it's going to breed confusion. But I think more importantly, if you keep with the Jenner standard, which admittedly this court used it in Steiner and Riley.
Yeah, I don't know if this issue was teed up in those cases.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think at most it was missed or may have been a mistake to apply that, because Jenner hasn't been good law since Cisney was adopted in 2008. Because the Schlosser case, which is the underlying legal authority for the Jenner no set of facts standard, was abrogated by Cisney. But I think the most important point about why there shouldn't be two different standards when it comes to habeas and other civil cases is if this court continues to apply Jenner, essentially that's a lower standard, and it's making it easier to plead a case to attack a presumptively valid judgment than it is to plead a case to get a judgment in the first place. And
so,
I think that...
So habeas has a very unique claim that is not a type of claim that you really see in any other type of civil case, which is this ineffective assistance of counsel. And you keep referring to there was nothing in the record, or you're referring to the record, and it's a claim which we can't address on direct appeal because there is no record laying out in allowing us to view through the lens of trial counsel whether there was strategy, what were the reasons behind that. That is something that has to be done in a habeas proceeding. So when you keep talking about we needed something more specific here, well, a lot of this has to be developed. It's not something that you can go backwards as far as the deficiency prong. You can look at the trial record for the prejudice prong. But isn't this a little bit different scenario that is sort of unique when we look at that particular type of claim?
Only in the sense when you're talking the ultimate proof, Your Honor, to get to establishing an ineffective assistance claim to be granted relief. At the pleading stage, no, I don't think it's inconsistent or unusual to require more than just a label or just a laundry list of statements that were in Malcolm's. There needs to be something more. It doesn't have to be extensive, but I think the best way to describe this petition of while it's 11 pages long, it's bare bones in the sense of a pleading standard and how the information's conveyed about putting the state on notice and setting the case up. And so I think even though while you're correct that there is that unique position, I think that's exactly why there shouldn't be any uniqueness when it comes to the pleading itself, because that doesn't have to factor in the individual claim. Again, like as Justice Jensen was saying, it's just a putting on notice. And so I think that's why it makes sense to have all of that come back to the same standard to prevent confusion, to give guidance going forward for anyone in the legal community working in the civil realm, not just in the habeas context.
What about the circuit court's order as it relates to the IAC claim? Petitioner has failed to show that his counsel's conduct fell below an objective standard, that he is prejudiced by counsel's conduct based upon the overwhelming video evidence of the crime. He goes on to say that the claim is speculative, vague, and unsubstantiated. Almost sounds like a finding, more so than an application of a pleading standard at a 12B5 stage.
I'll admit, Your Honor, it gets a little muddy there. But I still think when you connect that finding essentially with the statement that it's vague and conclusory, it still comes to the right result because, again, his petition just uses labels. And even in using those labels, as I was saying at the beginning of my argument, completely pleads Strickland analysis in the wrong way by saying cumulative error and also prejudice is presumed. So I think you connect those together. Therein lies the error with his petition and why this court should affirm the circuit court's dismissal. Going to the point that you talked about with the circuit court mentioning the overwhelming evidence, when looking at a motion to dismiss, this court and the circuit court looks at the face of the pleadings, which I think also includes the motion to dismiss and the state's brief. And when you look at that brief in support of the motion to dismiss itself, the state does go into the details of the videos and how those came out. So I don't think it was out of bounds for the circuit court to make that statement because that is something necessarily implicated in the analysis under the 12B5 framework. So I think ultimately it all comes back to what was in that petition. It was all labels. There wasn't labels plus. And I think whether this court continues to apply Jenner or whether it applies Cisney, both of those are clear that that's not enough, and it demands that the petition be dismissed. So unless the court has any further questions.
I do.
Okay.
Sorry. So you would read that as petitioner has failed to, instead of show, maybe allege that his counsel's conduct fell below an objective standard.
Yes,
that would
Your
maybe
Honor.
Make that more palatable to you, perhaps. But then what about the notion that the court brings in this overwhelming video evidence? How can the court at this early stage even consider or assess whether something's overwhelming or not or prejudicial? Would it change the result? Anything like that?
So, one, I think, is because the state did put it in its brief in support of the motion to dismiss. There's also the chance, and I don't think it's clear from this record, had it been made known whether or not Judge Party was taking judicial notice of the underlying record or anything like that, or this court's opinion. It's unclear from the record we have, so I think it's dangerous to assume that he did take judicial notice, but that could be another avenue for explaining that, Your Honor. But at the end of the day, this court can say the circuit court was right, even if it was for the wrong reasons that he went into that, because this petition is speculative and conclusory.
And we review it de novo in any event.
Correct. And with those speculative and conclusory labels, there's no facial validity of that petition, and so this court should affirm the circuit court's dismissal of the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Templer. Mr. Lindy, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor, counsel. The first thing I want to address, because I think the state is incorrect here, paragraph 28 of the amended application states, for the first time in closing, counsel argued that this was a botched investigation. Counsel argued that law enforcement obtained the video evidence in this case from a cell phone that was not identified in the search warrants. However, no motion to suppress had been filed in this matter prior to trial, and counsel failed to file a motion to suppress or object to cell phone video evidence in this case. Then, in the ineffective assistance of counsel portion of the claim, paragraph 47, Malcolm's counsel's conduct in this case fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, and Malcolm was prejudiced by counsel's performance as to be deprived of a fair trial. When I look at the court's decision adopting Strickland, this court has held that deficient performance results in prejudice when petitioner shows there's reasonable probability that for counsel's unprofessional errors, the results of the proceedings would have been different. Essentially, that's what was alleged in the amended application, that there was prejudice. I agree with the state that the chronic standard was pled, but I don't think that the rules prohibit anybody from making alternative theories in a pleading, and I don't think that should foreclose your ability to have some type of relief.
So if that's the IAC claim, which you incorporated 28 through your paragraph 44, but you would need more than just 28, right, to claim that there's a Fourth Amendment IAC claim. Because all you've really said at this point, when you get to the IAC claim, all you've really said is that that counsel made no motion to suppress, failed to file a motion to suppress or object to the cell phone. That doesn't state any legal theory regarding the Fourth Amendment. I mean, you get to that with your freestanding claim, of course.
Correct. Okay. And probably if complaint could be made, it probably would have incorporated that actual Fourth Amendment argument into more succinctly into the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. But going back to one of the questions to the state, I mean, the burden at this point in time under Rule 8 of the civil procedure is to basically put the state upon notice. And even considering Iqbal, and you look at those federal decisions on the pleading standard, they always go back to state that what is required is a short and plain statement of the facts. Most of those Iqbal decisions are actually dismissing pretty lengthy complaints involving fraud and other items that must be pleaded with particularity. And I think the question was posed to the state as to what type of pleading standard should be provided in this case. And I think the court is correct in keeping consistent with Steiner the more liberal pleading standard, because I think the court is in a tough position, because on direct appeal, even though some state Supreme Courts, like I know the Wyoming Supreme Court allows this, they allow some briefing as to the ineffective assistance of counsel and then may appoint another attorney. In this case, it has to be a separate habeas petition. The circuit court then is given the task of reviewing this information through an evidentiary hearing after the appeal is affirmed. So what should be allowed is that if the Supreme Court is not going to consider the habeas on the direct appeal, the circuit court that's considering this, standing there looking at Sixth Amendment claims, should be able to liberally consider the application and then consider this evidentiary hearing. Essentially, Your Honor, all Mr. Malcolm is requesting is that he receive an evidentiary hearing in this case. I believe that he's properly pled that there's a serious Fourth Amendment issue here, because under Riley, a search warrant needed to be obtained to search that phone. It wasn't. Law enforcement then searched that phone without a search warrant. Their later search warrants are totally tainted and don't cure that. In addition to that, we have a totally improper trial tactic that was asserted by counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindy. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is now submitted. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.